Good morning, everybody. Hey, that's better. It's 9:30 in the morning on a Monday at South by Southwest. What could be better than that, right? Yes, exactly. So my name is Craig Tomlin. I'm going to be doing introductions in a second. Standing next to me is my partner in crime, Rit. And we are here to tell you how to go from UX hell to UX sell. Before we get started, though, just a quick question. How many people here are involved in e-commerce? Raise your hand, please. Great, okay. How many in lead gen? Raise your hand, please. Awesome. Lead gen folks, don't go anywhere. There's a lot of information for you as well in this deck. So I came here in 2011. So my first South By was 2011. So ever since then, I've been in your seat and I've been seeing a lot of presentations as well as going to other conferences, as has Rit. And I can tell you, we both felt like what we needed to do here is give you everything that we always wanted from a South by Southwest session, which is lots of information, lots of data, and practical things that you can take back with you to work right away and use right away. So you're going to get that. We have 72 slides that we are going to get you through, and we will get you out of here on time if it kills us. So if you're ready, we're ready, and we're going to get started. Here we go. So I'm Craig Tomlin. I've been doing UX, which back in the olden days used to be called HCI, since the mid-1990s. I am a owner of WCT & Associates, which is my consulting firm. I do UX optimization training, UX research training. I also do UX optimization for large and small firms, everybody from AT&T, Dell, DirecTV, Disney, all the way to Zurich Insurance Company, and a whole host of others that you may or may not have heard of. If you want more information about me and the stuff I do and some examples of the work I did, you can go to my portfolio site. It's W. Craig Tomlin, my name, wcraigtomlin.com/portfolio, and there you can see some of the work I've done. I spent a year and a half, and I just published in October my first book, maybe my last book, because it took me a year and a half, and it's called UX Optimization, Combining Behavioral UX and Usability Testing Data to Optimize Websites. The South By book team wanted me to let you know that originally there was going to be a 10:30 book signing over at Level 3 in the Convention Center. I sort of explained to them that the whole Star Trek beaming thing wasn't going to work, and we were going to be here at 10:30, so they have moved that to 11. So they wanted me to tell you the book signing will be at 11, and then my publisher, A-Press, is down in the trade show. If you haven't been to the trade show, go check it out. There's bio-engineered sushi that's directly wired to your DNA, which is really cool, so go check it out. And that book signing is going to be at 2 o'clock. So check out the sushi and then come in and do the book signing, all right? And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my partner, Rit.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ritvij Gautam. I've been added for millennial relatability PR reasons. So I'm the co-founder of TryMyUI.com. We've been business for about 5 years. We're a remote usability testing tool. We help other companies see how usable their websites and apps are for their target customers. And the reason I want to kind of make that clear is the data we collect is video and audio recordings of your target demographic user going through a set of tasks on your site or your app and answering some questions after the fact. And that's the tool we've used to collect these 100,000 test results that we're about to talk about today. So I just wanted to let you guys know about that. I'm also the author of the book, This Sucks, A Guide to Better User Experiences. Check it out. It's a free ebook. It's on our website. I'm also the global entrepreneur in residence at San Jose State University, where I'm a guest lecturer and I lecture about entrepreneurship and stuff. So really quick, our agenda today. The first part is to walk you through the data and analysis from 100,000 usability tests. Now, we only have an hour to walk you through our whole talk, so we had to really pick and choose which of our learnings we could share with you. And it's a much larger data set, and it's something that we're constantly going to be working on and hopefully releasing white papers and stuff on as the years kind of go on. Then this kind of stuff we've looked at is common tests, the tasks that people have run, the pages that they've tested, and scores like the system usability scale score, the single ease question or task usability scores, as well as a whole bunch of other stuff. And then we've kind of taken those, used that to kind of do a deep dive into the video data and get some learnings and analysis and key insights to specifically help your e-commerce UX. And then after that, I'm going to hand out to Craig, who's going to do a quick overview of what this data means in the larger context of e-commerce UX in the e-commerce space, and how to benchmark yourself against some metrics and some best practices to conduct user research. Then we've worked on an interactive UX research checklist to see how your current UX research process stacks up. Right? Are you guys doing research? Is it going well? I'm pretty sure everyone in this room is doing phenomenal research, so I'm not even worried about it. But you know, it's a checklist that you can take back and just make sure that it works for you. And then we have time for some Q&A. So without further ado, let's get into it. So part one, data analysis from 100,000 UX tests. So our methodology, we aggregated and analyzed 100,000 plus TryMyUI e-commerce usability test results. We eliminated the incomplete data. As you can imagine, when the data set is that size, we had videos that were incomplete, videos that had technical issues, abandonment, et cetera. When you're collecting data samples at that size, that kind of becomes an issue. So we had to scrape it, clear those out, separated the remainder test results by mobile and desktop. Then we identified tests with significantly lower high scores. We looked at the tasks and pages tested, and we used those scores, cross-referenced it with the tasks to find tests and sites that had low scores for specific tasks like search or search, filter, checkout, etc. And then we were able to kind of do a deep dive into those tests and look at what are some patterns and commonalities that result in a bad UX or a good UX for that task. And the kind of data we looked at, right? It's kind of beating a dead horse at this point, but these are the kind of things that we looked at, and I'll talk about them a little bit more. But let me back up and ask a question. Why do product teams make frustrating products? It's clearly because our users are stupid and they don't understand how to use the product. I'm just kidding, guys. Product teams cannot anticipate all the ways in which their products may cause user frustration for two reasons. Right? The first is you have privileged information. You already know how the product is meant to be used. It would be like me asking you to solve a puzzle that you created like you'd never seen it before. It's something you can't do. You already know how it's supposed to be used. So it's hard for you to intuit the ways in which it may be used the wrong way or misused. Then the second thing is product teams may not share the same mindset or demographic profile as the end user, right? So if a couple of 20-something tech bros like myself are trying to create an app to help elderly patients track their diabetes medication, we might miss a couple of things out because we don't share the same demographics. So these two things, primarily, they lead to teams building difficult products that are frustrating for their end users. Now, a frustrating product in a competitive environment is unsellable, unmarketable, and doomed to fail, which is why this kind of research is so, so vital to do. So a quick overview of the data set. We actually had 101,240 test results. The split was about 60-40 in the favor of desktop. So there's already an insight here, right? What I can tell you is from the people that have been running tests using our platform, an overwhelming number of people are testing desktop experiences and not enough people are testing mobile experiences. Now, this could be one of two reasons, right? Either there are just more people have desktop sites than mobile sites, but Craig will bring in some data about traffic, et cetera, that'll show you that's not the case. So what this clearly tells me is people are focusing more on their desktop UX than their mobile UX, and that's something that's cause for concern. And then the average time on each video was about 18.5 minutes, so it was 3.5 years of video data, or 30,000 hours of video data. My company's only 5 years old, so I've not watched all the videos. It would be like watching Inception 12,000 times, which I love that movie, but I've only watched a normal number of times, like 15. So here's an overview of the data set, right? The largest part of our data, it didn't have any quantitative data associated with it, which made it very hard to access. So a common thing I hear from a lot of user researchers is, hey man, I would love to do more user research, but I just don't have the time. Right. Raise your hands if you said that to yourself in the mirror, alone, once at home, or like to your friend or someone. Right. People are always trying to figure out. I see some hands. It's okay. Everyone else lying. Don't worry about it. Right. People want to do this kind of research, but they just don't have the time. That's because video data is a clunky kind of data to work with. It's not a SQL database. It's very hard to query. Right. So you're constantly trying to figure out the best way to get insights from the video data without having to brute force through it. So the majority of our video data did not have any quantitative metrics associated with it. So that's about like 48% of it. And this made it very hard for us to access that data or analyze it in any way, shape, or form, at least right now. So now a couple of initiatives we're taking is we've included a transcription feature that we're going and we're generating transcripts for all of these videos, and then we're going to do some text analysis and see if we can find common terms, et cetera, used and access the data that way. But let me talk about the data that did have. The majority of the data did have some sort of quantitative metrics associated with it. We had the system usability scale, which without kind of going into too much detail, it's a post-test survey. It's got 10 statements, all positive and negative statements about the user sentiments about the platform, things like, I think I'd like to use this system frequently, or I found the system unnecessarily complex. And testers can rate each statement from a 1, which is strongly disagree, to a 5, which is strongly agree, or anything in between. And we capture the response for each tester. Some of the statements pertain to learnability, some of them pertain to usability, and we're able to give you a general system satisfaction score that's a composite of a usability and learnability subvector. Then we have the single ease question, which looks at task-based usability. So after each task, we ask users, on a scale of 1 to 7, how difficult or easy was this task? Where 7 is very easy and 1 is very difficult. And we capture that for each tester and all the tasks, so we're able to do an average usability line for the test, and we're able to see average task usability for the test. Then we have this crowdsourced, homegrown Try My UI feature called the UX Crowd, and I'll talk to you about that in a little bit as well. So how did I go through analyzing this? Clearly, can't binge 3.5 years of video, right? Already did that with The Office, don't want to do it again. So we went from a bird's eye view of the metrics down to the ground level insights. Right? We looked at the quantitative data, we looked at patterns in the quantitative data, which I'm about to share with you. Then we looked at those patterns as they pertain to specific tasks. Then we used that to go and watch representative videos and then look at the things in the videos that resulted in those patterns. So let's take a look at the results. So the first thing was, we separated the system usability scale scores by desktop and mobile, and we were able to sort of plot them out for the tests. So what we noticed is desktop system usability scale scores were 11 points higher on average than mobile usability. Now, what does this mean? Well, let me help put this in context. Right, this tells you that desktop scores are higher than mobile, but what does it mean for it to be higher than mobile? So this is a really good quartile breakdown of SUS scores and suggested objective rankings from the Journal of Usability Studies. So what this tells you immediately is, first of all, on a scale of 100, the quartiles are not broken down evenly, right? There's a clustering of the quartiles near the top end of the system usability scale. The top 50% of system usability scale scores collected by the Journal of Usability Studies, for example, tends to be at 71.4 or higher. And the adjective they use for 71.4 is good, and then it gets higher than that. So what we can tell from our earlier data is, from our data set, it's kind of worrying to see that while desktop scores are on the cusp of the cusp of a good experience, between a good between the second and the top quartile, mobile scores are actually on the cusp of the bottom and the third quartile, which is worrying, right? We can see that mobile experiences seem to be lagging behind desktop if we look at them through the angle of SUS. Now, you might ask me, dude, why are you saying SUS so much? Like, you said it a lot, and you seem to be hanging your coat on this metric. I use SuperQ, or I use the post-study system usability questionnaire, right? Or I use this metric that you've never even heard of because I'm hipster like that, right? And to that, I'd say SUS is not the only metric. You just got to find a metric that works and is valid. So what we did was we plotted SUS scores on the x-axis and SEQ scores, or the task usability scores, on the y. And this graph tells you two things. First, it sort of mirrors and mimics the quartile breakdown in the earlier slide, right? It shows you that there's a clustering of these scores at the higher end of the SUS scale. But the second thing it also shows you is it shows you that as SUS scores get higher, the average task usability scores get higher. So what it demonstrates is that better SUS scores correlate to easier experiences on tasks on average. So for us, this is a pretty good indicator and a pretty good metric to use. Then we looked at the difference in average task usability scores. And what we saw is, again, this kind of tracks with the SUS scores. The task usability scores seemed better on desktop than on mobile. The desktop experience is on a scale of 1 to 7, right? It's just, I just have it up till 8, so you could, like, the 7s didn't get cut off. But it's a scale of 1 to 7, and you can see the desktop experiences have a higher clustering up top, but mobile experiences seem to have a greater spread, and you know, they were down below. And desktop SUS scores on average, SEQ scores on average were a 6 out of 7, and average mobile SEQ scores were like a 3.7 out of 7, also telling you that mobile e-commerce experiences seem to be lagging behind desktop. So we were able to use these metrics, and then we were able to cross-reference them with the pages tested, right? So this is, over here, this is a common e-commerce funnel. People show up at the homepage, they perform some sort of search or filter action to find a product they want. They look at the details of the product, they compare it to other products if they can, they add it to a shopping cart, and they check out. So what we found is there were obviously a lot of people testing the homepage. Search and filter was about 50-50, depending on if they were running tests on the information architecture and, you know, seeing if the product catalog was good, or if they were checking to see how well their search function worked. But when it came down to actually looking at the product details, there was a sharp decline in the number of tests being run, or like number of tasks pertaining to the product details page. Very few people were spending time finding out, and this is about our customers, very few of our customers were spending time finding out, hey, does our product details page have enough information about the product to stimulate a purchase, right? So people really care about the navigation funnel, but they're not spending enough time looking at the content and how good the content is at stimulating a purchase. So what we were able to do is since we were able to sort by these pages, and we were able to get those metrics, we were able to cross-reference them and look at certain metrics on certain pages, and then we were able to use that to dive into some of the actual video data and get some learnings out of it. So and like I said, we had a lot of learnings. I just wanted to sort of distill it into learnings that I really wanted to share with you that I think would have the most impact. After we kind of got down to the tests that had the representative low scores, et cetera, that's where we got to use our UX crowd feature. So what we do is, when you're running usability tests, people are going to be voicing complaints and issues, et cetera, and it's your job as the researcher or designer to figure out whether a complaint voiced by a tester is a one-off instance or a persistent usability trend that affects everybody. And the only way for you to do that now is to brute force through the video data, make your notes, and retroactively tally which things affected the most people, which is a fairly inefficient way of going about it, even for like 10 videos. So you best believe for like 100,000 videos, that's like super inefficient. It's not an option. So what we started doing is we started treating the pool of testers as an intelligent group of people as opposed to isolated individuals. And by that I mean that after a tester finishes their test, we ask them 3 simple questions. What are 2 things you liked about the website or app? What are 2 things you didn't like about the website or app? And name up to 2 suggestions for improvement. And after testers give their responses to those questions, we drop them into a forum where they can see the responses of all other testers to those same questions. And based on when they join the forum, we give them a weighted vote currency, and they can vote up on other tester ideas that resonate with their own, and they can also comment on other tester ideas. So what you end up seeing without having watched a single video, right? This was one of the tests from our data set. They had 30 testers go through it, and we can see that 22 out of 30 testers said they did not like how they had to create an account before checking out. So this tool was instrumental in helping us kind of figure out, like, hey, what are some representative issues as reported by the tester in these tests after we were able to narrow them down through the metrics. So you can kind of see this process of kind of filtering down, and finding the insights. So here are some of those key learnings. The first one had to do with search, filter, and sorting. Now, some of these might sound obvious to you, but all I can say is from the data set of 100,000, these are some common patterns we found that caused extremely high task duration, extremely low task usability scores, and low sus scores in the search task. And so the first thing is having a common sense information architecture is like having a store with well-organized aisles. There's a reason why I walk into, you know, H&M, I don't shop at H&M. Walk into any of these stores and, you know, the shirts on one side and the pants on one side and then all piled in the center like one big bargain bin. It's because it makes things easier to find. But what we found is a lot of people, right, did not have their information architecture up to scratch, right? They had mistakes that kind of had their filtering out of whack, or a lot of their products weren't attributed to a specific filter, right? They had a lot of unassigned products. So there were products in their catalog, but there was no way to get to them through the information architecture. So that would be really problematic, right? If I use the information architecture to try and find a product you have, but I can't find it because of the information architecture, and I leave, right? That would be really frustrating. The other thing is, when your product catalog is massive, just using the information architecture is not enough. So searching and categorization becomes important. So there were two kinds of searches that we found e-commerce sites having. They had scoped search or non-scoped search. A scoped search is a search that allows you to narrow the scope of your search. Right? It's pretty self-explanatory. So the difference between searching all of this website for a desk lamp versus searching for a desk lamp within the subcategory of home and kitchen. And what we found is e-commerce websites that had scoped search, they had significantly lower task durations and higher task usability scores, which is awesome, but there's a catch. They had really bad task usability scores in the event the user didn't know that a scoped search was happening, right? If the UX does not communicate that, hey, dude, a scoped search is going on, people will search for something, think they're searching the whole website, and when you turn up a no results, they will leave frustrated, even though you have the product. So scoped searches can be helpful, but you need to be really, really careful, right, to make sure that the user knows that a scoped search is indeed happening. Then the last thing with the search is you have to ensure that product descriptions and keywords reflect common sense search terms. So this is one of a screenshot from one of the videos in the data set, right? We were testing, it was like a simple e-commerce website, and the name of these pants, the name of the color is The Witch is Dead. How many of you have ever searched for Witch is Dead colored things? Not me, ever. And the thing is, right, they're clearly like light blue or gray blue or something like that. But the thing is, you got to make sure that even though the product is called Witch is Dead, if I search light blue or gray blue, these pants show up. And they didn't for this e-commerce website, right? Even though they were searched, user searched light blue or gray blue or gray, these pants just didn't show up. So you got to make sure that even though things are named in certain ways, that the search terms, they are indexed by common sense search terms that your target user uses. So it actually reminds me of a case study. So one of our clients, a design agency, ran some tests on their client, a landscaping firm that sold like trees and plants, et cetera, for decor. And their client, right, their search used expert terms like coniferous, deciduous, spruces, junipers, which are all technically correct classifications for trees, right? But when they ran usability tests, they found that their users were turning up no results because they were using common sense terms like big, ornamental, outdoor, indoor, right? And their searches weren't indexed by these things. So what you ended up seeing was, so our client, the design agency, made some changes, aligned their filter to search and common terms, and the person had an 85% increase in their conversion rate and 147% increase in their revenue. And these kind of returns, they last in perpetuity. So the point is, you can make common sense, like these are common sense changes that I'm talking about, but the resultant effect is massive and results in, and pays off in perpetuity. So this is why this kind of research is crucial to do. The last learning was about checkout, right? This is a survey that Baymard ran on about 2,500 users this year about reasons for abandonment during checkout. Abandoning during checkout is crazy. It's something, honestly, from a UX perspective, we should make sure never happens, because it's like the equivalent of someone standing in a line, getting to the cashier, talking to them, and then being like, yeah, man, no, not it. Right? So what were the reasons that people reported? The first thing is the extra costs were too high. It's a common reason, right? There was like, okay, the shipping overhead or whatever seems higher. And that's something you can solve by just communicating it, or some people just might not be down with the price, and that's fine. But the next two reasons, the second highest reason is they had to create an account before checking out. They were forced to create an account, and that caused 34% of these people to abandon during checkout. And the next highest reason is it was a longer, complex process. So, and we saw this in our data set as well, right? In the checkout task, the moment there was account creation without an alternative, right, the task duration shot up. People were really just pissed at the end of it, right? And testers were like, if this was not a test that I had to go through, I would have left this checkout flow right now. And that's a message we heard over and over again, including the Southern lady who was like, everybody always asks you to sign up for something, which, you know, I felt like really encapsulated. It hit me in the feels. So the important learning is to keep the users focused on the task at hand, right? Account creation is a barrier to checkout. Unless you're a SaaS product and account creation is part of your, you know, is part of your tool, you don't need it, right? Guest checkout should always be an option. And the thing we found is people constantly reported through the UX crowd that return customers with accounts, people that are like, even if I've created an account, I'll return and I'll use the guest checkout if it's an option because I forget my password, right? So the argument people make for guest like account creation is, oh, the next time it's going to be way faster. You know, you can sign in and just check out. But the thing is, dude, people forget because it's not their bank, it's not their Gmail, it's not their Facebook. They don't need to remember this password, right? So in the event that people forget it, they have to go through a password recovery step. So you've just increased your checkout task, right? You've increased the number of steps in your checkout task. And then as for solving the third problem, only form fields that are absolutely critical, right? This is, again, an obvious one. Make sure that you're using form fields that are super important. And every time you add a form field to your checkout process, ask yourself the question, do I need this information for this person to buy this product? So key takeaways from just my section. Right, metrics work when you're doing your research, right? Use SEQ, use SUS scores. They help you benchmark. They help you iteratively check where you were and improve. They also help you see for a set of data where you need to be, right? Where in the video data the clusters of pain points are and access that accordingly. As for mobile, taking an experience from bad to good is way easier than going from good to excellent. The insights you need to go from like a 92 to a 95 are substantially higher than the insights you need to go from like a 72 to an 85 in SUS scores, right? Because those insights are more subtle and they take more work to get. And the yield is not as high. So as we've learned, mobile experiences seem to be lagging behind desktop. So my advice to you is focus on your mobile UX because that'll be easier to improve. Test your product details and product comparison pages, people, right? You gotta tell, that's honestly where the sales pitch of the product is. Make sure that people know, like, why this product is worth buying. And also, search terminology, remember the trees. Make sure you guys are using common sense search terms, and your search terms and your search is aligned with your user's terminology, lexicon, and expectations. And lastly, successful checkout, I'll take that anytime over account creation in an e-commerce flow. Always be closing, right? Make sure that the successful checkout is something that you don't impede with something like account creation. So I'm going to thank you so much. I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Craig, and I'll come back when we talk about the checklist, and we'll do questions at the end of the talk.
Thank you, Red. Very good stuff. Powerful. Powerful stuff, right? So what I want to do is spend the second half of this, part two, and I want to share with you some e-commerce aggregated trends for 2018, and I want to help you use this data to go and promote more UX research activity, more conversion rate optimization activity in your firm, unless you already have enough funds and resources to do all that, and my guess is you don't. So this is going to be important information that will help you put together the business case for why more is necessary. Also, this will help you to determine where you sit in the benchmark, if you're high or low. All right. Then the important question I have is, we're going to share these numbers together. You should know these numbers. If you're an e-commerce shop, lead gen folks, you're going to have conversion numbers as well. You should know all these numbers. Your UX team should know all these numbers, including UX designers, and I would suggest even developers. Everybody needs to understand the big picture of metrics. If that's not the case with your organization, I would suggest trying to change that. So it's a little bit hard to see on the screen, but I will walk you through this. First is consumer spending for 2018. The source is Adobe Analytics. So this is all of the Adobe Analytics crowd all grouped together. And this is for the time period of November 1st through December 31st of 2018. When we compare it to historic, you see on the left, it's about $108.8 billion was spent online in just those two months. Last year, it was $125.91 billion, which was slightly over the estimate of $124 billion. So we are talking real money here. E-commerce matters, and getting it right really matters. Let's look at the share of revenue by device. So again, the time period is November 1st of 2018 through December 31st of 2018. And what you'll see here is desktop was at 60% of that revenue with $75.9 billion, smartphone at 38.8, and then tablet at 11.2. Again, a little bit hard to read, but very important. So this is traffic versus revenue by device. And I think, yeah, take pictures of this. This is very important, or you can go to Adobe Analytics. Very important. So I want you to look at the orange line. That represents the total percent of purchases. On the left side, you'll see desktop. Desktop represented 60% of purchases. That white line represents the percent of traffic. That was 41%. So only 41% of traffic was generating 60% of revenue for desktop. Why? Smartphone. 51% of traffic. People are shopping on smartphones. You all shop on smartphones. But apparently, you and everybody else coming to e-commerce sites do not buy on smartphones. Only 31% of revenue. Why? And then tablet meets expectations, right? It was 8% of revenue and 9% of purchases. So that feels right. So what is happening with mobile? What is causing that? Why is mobile so bad, right? People shop with phones, but they're buying with desktops. Why? That's something that you all need to go back and look at. Now, the two biggest e-commerce days, this is no surprise to anybody, is Black Friday and Cyber Monday. And here you'll see a column on the left-hand side in terms of billions of dollars of revenue for those 2 days. And obviously, it's huge, right? So we all know if you're in e-commerce, usually there's a code lockdown. Usually it's in October. Sometimes it'll come up in November. But you have, the clock is ticking. It's about mid-March, right? You have from mid-March through April, maybe about 5 months, in order to put together some research, some analysis, put a business case together, go in and dive into mobile. We've already seen from Rit that mobile is a problem, right? His data verifies the data that you just saw. And you only have a set amount of time in order to try to determine what to do in order to optimize, hopefully, mobile, right? And get that into a better revenue state. Let's look at conversion by device. And this is just for Cyber Monday of last year, which happened to fall on the 26th. So you can see conversion, again, this is Adobe Analytics. You can see desktop was 7.4%. Smartphone was 3.9%, and tablet was 6.6%. So my suggestion to all of you is go back and look at your smartphone interaction very, very carefully. Do some deep dive research, gather a lot of information about it, and try and understand how to make that number go from 3.9 to 4.9 or 5.9 or, you know, hopefully 6.9, right? Because even going from 3.9 to 4.9 can represent huge revenue increases for your firm. Absolutely huge. So that's the low-hanging fruit, in my opinion. Now, if there's only one thing you remember from this session, that is investing in advertising temporarily improves sales. Investing in advertising temporarily improves sales. How many of you folks are in marketing? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Well, I do marketing too, but I'm going to tell you, take some of the revenue that you're going to put into advertising, pull it out and put it into UX research. Figure out how to do conversion optimization on the mobile side. I guarantee you it's going to be huge, because investing in UX optimization permanently changes your conversion. You know in marketing and you know in product that you can do advertising. You can temporarily bring more people to your site and get more sales. But as soon as that money runs out and that traffic goes away, so does your revenue, but not with UX optimization. This is a permanent improvement in conversion. So it's a one-time spend to permanently improve the rate of conversion, which is always going to be very, very positive ROI. All right, so let's look at some of the other information that I think is going to help you when you are out there promoting more UX research and more conversion optimization. That's what to do and what not to do. So let's say that you successfully sold the idea that we need to do a lot more into this, we need to take this seriously, and we need to do it now, right? So what is the stuff that you need to do now? So on the left axis, you'll see effort, and going across the bottom, you'll see fidelity, meaning it takes a little bit more energy to go up the y-axis, and fidelity is more concise the further you go on the x-axis, and the y being effort. So raise your hand if you or somebody in your organization has asked you to do a competitive review. I'm sure everybody has. Now, there's a good thing about a competitor review. It tells you where you are, and it helps you to benchmark what you're doing versus your competitors. But how many of you have had somebody, maybe in the C-suite, or you know, maybe somebody in product, who knows where, say, well, gosh, they're doing it, so we should too, right? Yeah, right, it's everybody. So the things that you're going to be looking at when you're doing your competitive review are page structure, visual treatment, how the content is being utilized. There are other kinds of things you can look at. That's easy to do. It's easy to do a competitive review. But the problem with that is you have no idea why they're doing the things they're doing, right? So this is kind of a ditto effect. It's like, well, they're doing it, so I guess we should do it too. Why? I have no idea. They're just doing it. Okay, there's a better way to do this, and many of you, I'm sure, are already doing this, and this is through quant, right? You're doing quantitative analysis. You're going into Google Analytics, maybe, you know, Adobe, and you're getting some important information like time on page, bounce rates, top pages, top products, top exit pages, right? The session flow, you're probably looking at all of that, and that is very, very helpful data. That is the what is happening data, right? And that data is extremely helpful, except it doesn't tell you something. It doesn't tell you why it's happening. So to get to the why, you have to do qualitative, right? The qualitative takes not too much work. There's awesome tools. You know, Ritz got Try My UI. There's five-second tests, click tests, scroll maps that you can get through a variety of tools. It doesn't take a lot of energy to get that data. But it provides you a lot more information and a lot more detail, right? And so that is the why it's happening data. But what's that in the upper right quadrant? It's combining quantitative and qualitative data. And after 20 years, actually over 25 years, of being on the usability side and being on the marketing side, I combine both, and over the 20 years, I started realizing this is the secret to success. Look at what is happening and use that to identify where you should look at why that's happening, and based on that, you're going to have what I call a 360-degree view into your data set, which is going to give you far more informed visibility into what's happening, why it's happening, and therefore what to do about it. It's way, way better than guesswork, and it's way better than just looking at quant. And it's also way better than looking at just qualitative, okay? So that is what plus why it's happening. It's harder to do, it takes more effort, but the fidelity is super high. So now you've sold your process, right? People in your organization have agreed, they wanna do this. You know what you need to do, right? Which is you need to take that quantitative data and the qualitative data and look at it together. So, do's and don'ts is pretty straightforward. Don't spend a lot of energy and time on competitor mimicry. Spend a lot of time on quantitative and qualitative analysis. So, now you know where you're going to be spending your time, you know how you're going to be doing it. So, the next thing is what tools do you use? And the tools you use are going to depend on the questions you have. And the questions you have are going to vary. So depending on the question, you're going to want to reach to a certain tool. You might be using moderated usability testing. That's awesome for doing buy flows, show me scenarios. It's a wonderful tool. It's not best if you need quick data or low fidelity information. It's also not necessarily scalable or as scalable as other tools. Unmoderated usability testing is way scalable, right? Like you heard Rit, we could get 30 people to all go and go through a task flow together, and we could do that in a day and have results very quickly. So that is very, very helpful. There are some issues, right? Like it's not necessarily easy to do probing and follow-up, but with a good protocol and by making sure that you find participants who match your personas, you're going to get pretty darn good information. Now, there's other things like guerrilla usability testing, and then there's other tools like a five-second test, eye tracking, question tests, card sorts and reverse card sorts, tree sorts and reverse tree sorts. Those tools would have been helpful for that landscape company to figure out what they should actually be calling their trees, right? Big, not deciduous. And then click tests, automated eye tracking, and there are other ones. This is your toolkit. If you are not using all these tools, then maybe you're not looking for all of the right information. Maybe you're not asking all the right questions. So make sure you've got a toolkit where you use these when you need to find specific sets of data. Okay, so let's say you've moved forward, and now we're into actually where we're doing our testing. So maybe it's April or May, right? And we're doing usability testing. And so there's a couple do's and don'ts. I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. I suspect you all know a lot of these already. Do ask show me questions. Do probe for details. Do ask open-ended questions. Watch for nonverbal clues. And always answer a question with a question. Keep your script, and make a script, by the way. Have a note taker and a moderator. So I have found over the years that as I'm a moderator, it is very difficult for me to clue into nonverbal cues that are going on when I'm moderating sessions, and probably you find the same thing. So my recommendation is, if at all possible, have a note taker. Keep your participants on task. Try to not let them get off task. Now, for usability testing don'ts, don't use the words assume or pretend. Well, why do I say that, right? Like, it's okay. You know, I'm not expecting somebody to, you know, and go out and buy a pair of really cool Which is Dead jeans, right? Actually, you do, as best you can, need to find participants for your testing that match personas and that have a real need for these things. So the way to do that would be to go find people that are actually in the market or have recently shopped for jeans, and then ask them to go through the task flow and see if they can find the Which is Dead blue jeans. Rushing the participant, obviously we don't want to do that. Ask leading questions. Keep your head down. That's a tricky one. So if you're by yourself, you're probably going to be, you know, scribbling a lot of notes as you're going through the session. That's tough because, again, you're missing those nonverbal cues potentially, right? So having a note taker helps with keeping your head up as you're moderating a session. Answering questions directly, we talked about that. Don't wander off the script. If you suddenly uncover a shiny penny, just make a note of it that, this is something we need to follow up with, and then move on with the rest of your protocol. Keep everything very non-biased and very linear. And then only provide raw session videos is a great way to have your, you know, developer team, your UX designers fall asleep. Because nobody wants to sit there and watch 3, 4, 5 hours of usability testing. So cut those videos up, put them into highlight reels, and share them that way. It takes more energy and time, but if you want people to actually get the concept quickly, that's a really key thing. And then, of course, you saw some of the tests we use for data. Make sure you're using the correct test for data. Okay, so awesome. Now, what do we test first? This is a very, very common question I hear all the time. Sometimes people say, well, I should be testing something because my CEO said so. Well, that's a viable answer. But if the CEO doesn't tell you what to test first, then my suggestion is use our brick and mortar retail friends' way of handling it, planograms. How many people here know what a planogram is? Raise your hand, please. Okay, so for all of you that don't know what a planogram is, retail establishments, also casinos, by the way, will plot out every square foot of retail space, and they will also plot out every inch of shelf space, and they will know absolutely in real time all kinds of data. For example, shelf capacity, days of supply left, average sales per week, average gross profit per week, and a lot more data. They use this information to create planograms to move items around in the shelves that they know they can maximize and get additional revenue out of. And they are doing this all the time. Planogram changes are very common. Go into your grocery store, every time something gets moved around, it was because of data that led to a planogram. We can do the same thing in e-commerce or in lead gen. We should know what our which of our products have the best revenue and margin and which don't. And we should be focusing on the high margin, high revenue products first, just like a planogram in a brick and mortar retail store. So what to test first? Go for where the money is first. Why should you also do that? What's another reason for doing that? Because let's say, they're not really wild. Your execs maybe aren't wild about adding additional resources, time, energy into doing the research. Well, come out with a win and do it with a high margin item, and I guarantee you they will be sold and want to do a lot more on the lower margin items. So that's really key. So when to test, right? I get asked this question a lot, like, when should we be testing? And there are still many engineers and developers that think you shouldn't be testing until they actually have a live site. Hopefully you all know that's not the case. So impact versus difficulty, right? So difficulty on the bottom, impact is going up. The biggest impact you can make when conducting UX research and UX testing is at the wireframe stage. Why? Because you're pushing pixels. You're not pushing code. The hardest thing to do is to change a live site, and I'm sure you all can nod your head and say, yes, that is a major bear, okay? So you should be testing early and often, all along the life cycle of product development or product optimization or product redevelopment. Wireframe stage, raw prototype, working prototypes, and the live site, and you should be doing this continually. Okay, so I want to make sure that I give you guys time, so get your cameras ready. Everybody's going to take a picture of this. And then what I want you to do is grab some note paper, and Ritt's going to join me. Grab some note paper, and you're going to do this is a checklist for you. You're going to take this checklist back, and it's going to help you to identify where in your process you might need to do some optimization. So this is something you can directly take back and use tomorrow, or today, for that matter. So here we go. It's a little hard to see, so everybody take a picture of it, zoom in, I'll give you a second, and then we're going to start going through this. So I'll give you a second to take pictures. Let me know when you're all done. Put your cell phones down when you're all done taking the picture, and then get ready to take notes, okay? You're going to be answering these questions. All right, I see most of you are done. Okay, so I'm going to take the odd questions, and my buddy right here is going to be taking the even questions. So let's go. Oh, and by the way, be truthful, right? You need to know for a fact that you're going to be helping yourself if you are completely honest with this. And this is a test just for you. You're not sharing it with anybody, okay? So number one, how often do you test? Are you testing ongoing? And what I mean by ongoing is, let's say that you put together a new funnel path and you tested it, awesome. Have you gone back and retested it from time to time to just check that it's still working the way it's supposed to be working? If you are doing that and you're testing ongoing, give yourself a point. If not, no points.
Are you using objective vectors to iteratively measure your usability? And what I mean by objective vectors are numbers like the system usability scale score or the SEQ score that will allow you to benchmark your usability and track it every time you come out with a new iteration. Is your new version better than your previous version? Are the SUS scores better? Is the task duration lower? Is the system usability scale score better? Right. So if yes, give yourself a point. If no, give yourself 0 points.
Do you require account creation? So Ritt went in on very great detail about that, right? So we already know if you do not require account creation, give yourself a point. If your system does require account creation for checkout, no points.
Is your smartphone conversion significantly behind your desktop conversion? Now, again, right, this is lost revenue, money left on the table because more people shop. So if no, give yourself a point. Great. If yes, give yourself 0 points.
Perfect. So R assume or pretend in your protocols. If not, give yourself a point. If they are, no points.
And do you have a good SUS score? Is your SUS score at about like 71.4 or above? If yes, give yourself a point. If below that, give yourself no points. And if you don't know it, give yourself like minus 10. Just kidding.
Well, you could give yourself a minus 1, I suppose. So do you have common sense search terms? And think about this very carefully. Are you potentially using the witch is dead for a color? Now, that's an obvious you're probably not, but be very cautious when you answer this question. Are you using common sense search terms because you've actually asked your users and you know for a fact what search terms they use? If you do, awesome. Give yourself a point. If not, no points.
Do you use multiple testing methodologies? You know, Try My UI is great. I love it. No bias there. But there are a lot of different testing tools that are good for different reasons, right? As Craig said. So are you using the right multiple testing methodologies and you're using the right one for the right reason? If yes, give yourself a point. If no, give yourself 0 points.
Okay. UX design team. Again, we talked about this earlier, right? Do they have visibility into all the metrics that we just shared? And do they know those metrics for your organization? If they do, that's awesome. Everybody's being well informed. Give yourself a point. If not, no points.
Lastly, are you testing across all stages of the design process? Right? As Craig said, moving your pencil on a piece of paper and changing a wireframe is way easier than pushing new code and iterating on a live site. So are you testing at all stages of the design process? If yes, give yourself a point. If no, give yourself 0 points. So now, We've gone through the 10 statements, right? Take time, tally your scores up, and by a show of hands, how many of you got 6 or higher? All right, how many of you got 10? Anyone 10? All right, so clearly, right, there's work that needs doing on user research because it's intuitive stuff, but the resultant effect can be exponential on your revenue. This is something for you to take home, something for you to work on, right, when you take it back. So without further ado, I know we're like reaching the end of our talk, so quick time for question and answers. There's a mic up front. If anyone's got questions, check it out. And also, if you have to rush to another talk, Craig and I are going to be at the conference today. Hit us up. But any questions right now?
Wow, we communicated so well that no, oh.
Okay.
When you're conducting qualitative research, do you ever send folks to actually purchase products from the website and use their location of the
Can I take that one?
You can take that one.
Yeah, so this is something that our customers ask us all the time, right? You got to understand, when you're doing testing with people, especially like if it's like remote, unmoderated, and people are going through the testing flow, and now this site is asking them to put their credit card down and make a purchase, people get really like turned off by that, right? And the resultant effect can just have a ripple effect on just tell them like, hey, it's bad, it's sketchy, etc. When that's got nothing to do with your website, it's just the way you set up the test. So what a lot of our customers do, they do one of two things, right? They usually create like a beta environment or a test environment for that site, and they create like a whitelisted credit card number that the site will accept, right? It's just not a live purchase site, and they allow them to go all the way through the purchase flow with it. And we found that that works pretty well. So that's what I do. Yeah.
By the way, and we can still do Q&A, so if you have a question, please come up. But again, South By wanted me to remind you, and you can go ahead with your question, but they wanted me to remind you that the time change, it's 11 o'clock for the book signing, the UX optimization book, over at level 3. That's where I'm going to head to right after this. I'm going to head over there. And then there's another book signing with the publisher at 2 o'clock. So that's a change in the schedule from what was published earlier in the week. Okay. Please.
What data do you see in other or UX?
So the data sets that we used were collected using the TryMy UI platform, and we used them. So the data sets you were looking at is across all of our customers' data. We scrubbed it of like identifying information of the customers, and then we looked at certain score markers, et cetera. So that's the data I collected. Then the data Craig shared was from the Adobe Analytics Unwrapped metrics,
global.
Which is global. Yeah. Yeah. All right. And also my data is global as well. So it was like US e-commerce, UK e-commerce and stuff. Yeah. Hey, Kate.
I work for the National Memorial Group. We do a lot of research into general web applications, like very broad user groups, so look across multiple products and multiple users. One thing we identify frequently is that there is a little bit of preference that people have in terms of what their device is going to be using in certain tasks. So I'm going to come back to some of those stuff.
Yeah, so I think that's a fair statement. Everybody has a preferred device. Everybody has a preferred way. Some people like to text. Some people like to send emails. Some people like to talk on the phone. So that definitely is a part of it. But the numbers that you saw were so drastic and so dramatic, as well as RIT's numbers in terms of SUS scores and the SEQ scores were so dramatic that it's impossible to not say that if we focus a little bit more time and energy on it, we couldn't potentially move it up. Does that mean that there aren't a certain set of the population that won't shop by phone and then go to the desktop because they're more comfortable with that? Sure. But I would also argue that there's probably just as many people that would be interested if there was a better user experience on the mobile side of just going ahead and tapping and buying things right then and there. So good point, you know, valid point, part of the data. So thank you very much. Yes.
So I think what you're stating, right, is the fact that people aren't going to, let's say, buy a car online, right? Or it's like very hard for people, especially like on a mobile phone, to like drop, you know, 30 grand on the spot. That is, we noticed that there's like this price limit, right? For example, there was like a test that was done on purchasing like an insurance plan online through like a bank. Right, and a lot of people, they went through the flow. The flow that was being tested was set up to go all the way through to like a purchase. Like you sign up for the insurance and you get it and you check out. But a lot of people were like, I don't know, like I'd actually prefer to go into a bank and talk to someone real in person and make the purchase. Like it's cool to get all the information from here, but I don't think I'd make that checkout. Right. So we got insights like that, and I think that's perfectly valid. I think there is like, there will be an equilibrium point when we'll reach a point where improving the UX is not going to have an impact in revenue. I'd just say we're very far away from that point still, right? There are a lot of purchases people could make online if the mobile UX was better, but they don't right now because it's not. But eventually, I definitely think, yeah, it'll be a while before we start purchasing like insurance and like cars and homes online. Yeah.
Short call, jump on the line method, such as.
going to do that.
So let me understand your question. I want to make sure I'm understanding the synthesis of it. Can you help me?
Yeah, so you talked a lot about public research.
Right. Yeah, no, the quant will tell you where your flow is failing, either on mobile or desktop. The quant is going to give you the why, right? So you're going to be interviewing your testers, you're going to be finding out, you know, what's happening, you're going to be probing and doing follow-up questions with them. And so I think on any, you know, given website, there's always going to be different whys. Some of the aggregate whys you heard, right? There were problems with product pages, there were problems with pages that also did comparisons of products. You saw the data that Rick shared earlier. And then, of course, there are some other issues with mobile. You mentioned one of them, which is maybe your data is not being saved, and so that's kind of a hassle. So the qualitative coming from the quant is something that you would have to probe and research based on your own specific quantitative measurements. Oh, good. Thank you. Yes?
Hey, guys. I'm a member of the online team. I have a pretty basic question. In my first conference,
Yeah, are you in e-commerce or in lead gen?
We're B2B.
You're B2B? So, You can't use all the e-commerce data I shared earlier, because obviously that's all around the retail space. But there is plenty of conversion information. Part of it was some of the information that Rich shared in terms of SEQ and SUS scores. But you can certainly do some research on your own site to start measuring those scores and benchmarking them, and then asking your executives a what-if scenario. What if we were to take our conversion from 3.9 to 4.9%? What sort of revenue generated per lead, or revenue generated per MQL or SQL or whatever the metric is, what would that look like if we were able to take that to the next level? Can we generate an additional $1 million worth of revenue if we went up one level? Okay, great. Then let's invest and put in $50,000 or $100,000 into doing a robust study to figure out exactly how to take that to the next level. So that would be my suggestion there.
Piggybacking off Craig, every time, we work with like a lot of design agencies, and agencies have the added challenge of they're not trying to convince internally, right? They're trying to convince their client who's paying them of like, hey, our research is actually working for you, right? So they really try and make it about the revenue. So in the event like they're able to identify like a choke point or like a point of churn, right? They're able to take that and use the client's like products, et cetera, to generate like a model around lost revenue. And that's something that resonates really well with stakeholders, right? Anytime you're able to relate like UX shortcomings to a bottom line impact, that's huge. And that gets people listening every time. All right.
Thank you.
And I think this is the last one we'll take today. So, hey, what's up? Absolutely. So I think there is a lot of great literature, and eye tracking technology has gotten like a lot better from what it was when it started. And I think Craig could really speak to that as well. And I think incorporating those, right, will help you kind of hit upon unconscious decision-making processes within the user. And this is something that we are actually starting to think about a lot in the way of how people give feedback. We found that there's two modes, right? There's the rational mind, that, and like when you ask someone a question, they're able to give you a rational response. But then there's like unconscious decision-making processes that happen in a way that people cannot explain, but they do happen. And so things like eye tracking, heat maps, etc., kind of give us an insight into what are people looking at, even if they don't realize that they're looking at it. And I think that definitely adds value. It's just for the purpose of this talk, right? Like eye tracking is like heavily scientific. So I could, like, there could be a whole other talk about eye tracking and its benefits, and also like its shortcomings in like giving you high fidelity results. So it needs to be coupled with something else to give you high fidelity results. So I think like there is a room for biometrics, and it's up and coming. And I think using it is huge. But I think right now by itself, there's a limit to the amount of insight it gives you.
Yeah, the biometrics, eye tracking being a case in point, are very valuable for answering specific questions, right? So if you have specific questions, like you want to know where there are fixations that are occurring that shouldn't be occurring, right? And where are there good fixations where that are occurring on things that you, design elements that you want people to see, perfect. Eye tracking is great. Eye tracking won't help you at all to uncover, you know, the why. Like, why didn't somebody click on that button? They saw it. There were lots of fixations, right? But they didn't click on it. So then you have to use other tools in order to uncover the why. But it absolutely is a great tool, and it is one of the tools that I had in the recommended list. Thank you for the question. Everybody, thank you. I think that's it for our time.
Yeah. These are emails. Yes. Let's chat. Meet up with me. I don't have any friends in Austin, so I'd love to make some, and let's hang out. All right, guys, thanks for coming out.
Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.